someone else's pocketbook and stuff. You know, and a lot of people have said this, and you know, it seems like a whole bunch of BS at first, but if you really come to think about it, you know, it's terrible. I mean, the way police are you know, going around insulting other people, and then when you say something back to them quickly, you're wrong, and their first remedy is their billy club.
Yeah. Have you ever been beaten?
Yes, I was.
As a drag or the way you are now?
As the way I am now.
And what was the provocation?
Well, I was walking down the street with two friends of mine. And so, you know, like, we were talking and so forth and so on. So this one cop said, hey, faggot, how about a blowjob?
How about a what?
Blowjob.
Yeah.
So I said, well, why don't you go ask your mother? After all, she was the one who brought you into the world. Why not ask her? You know, so then I was wrong, you know, because I shouldn't have answered him. But still in all, that was no reason for him to come upon me and beat me the way he did.
And how exactly did he beat you?
Well, he took out his billy club. First he slapped me, then he took out his billy club, hit me across my legs, and he knocked me through a window. As a matter of fact, I still have a mark on my leg.
Where was the window? Where were you? Was this at Times Square or in the village?
At the village.
In the village?
Yes.
How long ago?
This was about 6 months ago.
And have you had any friends or that have been arrested, or have you been arrested?
Yes, I have, many a times, for loitering, soliciting, even though I don't know why I'm soliciting. If a man comes up to me and asks me for a match, you know, I don't see how I can be soliciting.
And have you spent any time in jail, or were the charges dropped?
One night, yes.
The charges are always dropped?
Yes, and it's embarrassing because, and it's a hassle because you have to go down there, you have to be insulted by the people who are there, and then, you know, just to hear the judge say, case dismissed, you know, case closed.
They're calling for another CPS.
Oh, really?
So, like, they won't let them march down 42nd Street. And so
wait, they won't let us march on the sidewalk even?
No.
Oh.
And so they're calling for another TPF unit. Which means it's going to be...
Well, no, the media's here, so maybe that'll save our heads a little
right
bit.
The ACLU's in the front there. They won't let them march down.
Speaking with the Civil Liberties Observer on the legality of the two banners, the two banners are wider than two abreast. And,
Is that the only thing holding up
that's
the march?
That's the only thing holding up the march at the present. Is, the question is the fact that the GAA banner and the Gay Liberation Front banner are wider than two abreast.
There's no law saying we have to be two abreast.
We have to be two abreast, yes.
No, there isn't. The police captain of the TPF asked me, but there is no law requiring that.
Well, if we are more than three abreast really or three abreast, really it is considered a parade. We don't have a parade permit.
I went down to police headquarters and they said, we told them what we would be doing here. We said we'd be marching up on the sidewalk. And they said we will not need a permit. They said just so long as we leave half the sidewalk clear.
To the banners, leave half the sidewalk clear?
Yes, the sidewalk is like,
well, let's go talk to the...
No, I can't take long banners.
Why not?
But the safety of the people in this building. The whole theater building, everyone is occupied at this time.
Is there any trouble?
Yeah, you're right.
Inspector, the crowd is restless. We better move them. We better move them because they're getting restless.
You're the marshal, not me.
Okay, well, just want to tell you because this is what we've been waiting for.
I'm not holding it. I'm just telling you what your ground rules are.
Okay, let's march!
Fire!
now about 9:45 p.m. And it looks as though the line of march is a bit shorter. The picket line, I guess you'd call it, is a bit shorter than it was earlier. But perhaps it's merely better organized. The marchers are still marching in twos. There's a sign in Spanish. Can't read it. And yes, the line of march is shorter. It's a bit more compact, a bit more together, but it's definitely shorter than it was before, as the demonstrators have circled around the street, 42nd Street, first across the south side, and then the north side, and then the south side.
Get a shave, take your head off, take a bath. What they're wishing to do, the hippies and everything.
Where do you recommend stop?
Well, I can't recommend any gay bar. I mean, you know, I mean, that's the problem, that gay people have no place to go. We need to open up a community center in New York, or go to a dance the GLF holds, so you can meet people in that non-cruising way. But like this, I mean, have you ever been into the whole cruising scene?
Yeah, we're from Philly.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really alienating. I couldn't hack it, I know, when I was in New Haven. Couldn't hack that whole bit of like standing there, and if you look at someone, that means you cruise them. And so you look straight ahead until there's somebody you like, and then they look at you, and that whole signal bit, you know? And like, I remember the first time I went into a gay bar, and there was this guy who looked nice, and I walked up to him, and he had some lover who was playing some butch role, and the guy came up to me and started ripping me apart. You know, it's just really oppressive, you know? And like, you can't just ask someone to dance and talk to them for 10 minutes and then split, because there's always that sex thing. And it's like, it's so hard to relate to people, like, in other just, other than in purely sexual ways. What I'm, like some of the things we're struggling with in GLF is that gay men always relate to each other on this fantasy level. You know, you pick up some good-looking numbers, and you build this whole fantasy, and then you make love to the fantasy. And when you try to break out of that fantasy, it's like so hard, because you have to deal with people, you know?
It's now Sunday night, August 30th. 1970. This is the day after the march. And after the march, the marchers left the 42nd Street area, came down to 8th Street between 6th Avenue and 5th Avenue. And there some violence occurred. And tonight there's been yet more. First of all, what happened last night after the 42nd Street march? The marchers marched down 8th Avenue. And then where?
We went from 42nd Street down past the precinct on 35th, and then down to Christopher Street. We passed the House of D. We stopped about 5 minutes and did a chant. Went down to Christopher Street to the Haven. When we got to the Haven, very coincidentally, it was being raided. So there was some scuffling with the police. We got word that the women in the House of D were rioting. They'd been stirred up by the demonstration. We went back to the House of D, and the street was filled with pigs, and we ended up in a riot, a full-scale riot.
No, the pigs ended up in a riot. The people were the victims of that riot. The police rioted against the people. Also, on the way down 7th Avenue, two brothers were hit in the head, one with a rock that was shown, and the other guy with a glass, some kind of glass.
A bottle. I understand that somebody was beaten bloody.
Yes, a number of people were. I was
chased by the police.
Yeah, it was right over here in the mall. I saw it happen. He was chased. They caught him. They chased him about a half a block. They caught him. About four or five pigs beat him down, opened his head completely. The street was covered with his blood. This morning in the courtroom,
They're claiming that he pulled a knife on a cop. They beat him so badly that they've got that he did not pull a knife. He had no knife. The closest I could come to it was he tried to kick a cop in the ass and didn't even connect. But his condition was so bad that they had to claim he pulled a knife on the cop. He didn't. We bailed him out this afternoon. It was $500 bail. GLF bailed him out today.
He's all right now?
Yeah, his head's pretty bad, but he's walking and he's all right.
Do you know him?
No, never met him before today. There was a black man over here by the library. Ronnie and I were standing, told to move on. He was confused. He moved the wrong way. Four pigs beat him down completely. He was in court today too. There were 10 people arrested last night. 3 were released on Vera summonses. 7 were in court this morning. The guy that was beaten over here was $500 bail, and then 2 street kids being held in $500 bail each, being held on burglary, grand larceny charges, a whole bunch of bull. We're bailing them out in the morning. All the other people were paroled until trial date. One guy was beaten in the station. We sent him to St. Vincent's. It looked like his nose was broken. All of the people were beaten. There was a lot of bad.
There were 2 others over here on 8th Street after that first guy whose head was split. That first guy who got it in the middle of the street. There were 2 others, I think it was a brother and a sister, and the both of them were beaten down to the ground. Not seriously though, not as bad.
They weren't in court.
They were let out last night. I don't know about the sister, I know about the brother though, because I know him personally, and he was out.
And what happened tonight?
Last night, I think, was a very valid political explosion. It had to happen, and it happened. And I think it had great validity. It had great political consciousness. I was against tonight's demonstration. There's still 2 people in jail. I spent from 8 o'clock this morning to 5 o'clock with other GLF people in the courtroom today. And we didn't have enough money at 5 o'clock, and we had to turn our backs on those 2 people and walk out and hope to come back tomorrow. I think we should cool it until we can get them out of jail, let their wounds heal. Tonight, as far as I'm concerned, the police were brutal. They are brutal. But I think they were provoked. I think people came down here and wanted it.
No.
Wanted something to happen, whether they wanted to be beaten or not. I believe they wanted something to happen.
They wanted the street.
All right, look, I'm giving my opinion. I live
I'm
here.
Sorry.
I've worked with these street kids. You can do 2 things with them. They're very bright. You can exploit them, or you can bring out the good in them. A lot of the kids from last year that nobody gave a nickel for are doing fine this year because people took an interest in them. Or you can look for the basic part in all of us, and which exists in anybody that has to live on the streets the way these people do. And I'm sure you get up there in the front of the march and throw Bob and do this, and got right on and all that, and they'll do it. They've got a pretty rotten life down here, doing parks and drugs over all the time. Or you can try to appeal to them. I think tonight they were appealed to me. And it's funny, at every demonstration, it's mostly these people that end up hustling. And I think they're used and exploited by me. When I say us, I'm including myself. And I resent it. And tonight, I really feel for the demonstration to make trouble. And I watched. I saw it last year. I live here. Most of these people don't live here. They come down here. This is their little playground. You know, I know what happened last year. I watched the reaction of the cops. The same thing. Beat for beat. They smile, they stand around, they're waiting. Ronnie can tell you, kept saying, it's not gonna last much longer. They're still smiling. It's not gonna last much longer. One bottle breaks, another bottle breaks. Sure, you attract every freak in the village. You can't come down here and wrap a nice little tidy package and say, we're GLF, we're gonna do this. It's not that kind of a place. You're gonna get a lot of crazies. You're gonna get a lot of finks. You're going to get pigs. You're going to get everything in there. Bottles are going to be thrown. Cars are going to be overturned. It's going to happen. And that's what started happening. And we waited and we waited and we watched.
Well, what exactly happened tonight after they marched down Christopher Street? What happened?
They marched up and down and up and down and up and down. And, you know, well, then what do you do next? They marched them over to 6th Avenue. You go here, you go there. A few bottles get thrown, a few more bottles get thrown. People get very restless. You just can't march people around. You start picking up all kinds of people. You got people that want to do their own thing. And they just kept it up and kept it up until the pigs said, this is it. We're going to break it up. And sure, they were brutal. Pigs are pigs. They're not called pigs for nothing.
How many were there?
I don't know. I stayed on the fringes of it. But I could have called it almost to the minute that the pigs were going to do it. Well, I've lived through these riots. You know, people come down here, they go home now. I got to live here.
Yeah. Were there more beatings tonight?
More what?
More beatings?
I don't, maybe equal. I don't know, Charlie. I can't say. I was not as close tonight as I was last night. I believed more in last night.
Did the rain cool it? Did the rain cool it? Or did the...
I think it was on the way out. You know, the people had been beaten. You know, the martyrs were made. Time to go home. I don't know, I'm very bitter about tonight. Extremely. Very.
Barely out of the last conflict and there's another one.
I'm sorry?
Barely out of the last conflict and there's another one.
Yeah. And I couldn't see the reason for it tonight. And what I saw was people begging and begging and begging for it. And you don't have to beg much with pigs. They're ready all the time.
Wasn't there a general feeling of anger against the police for what happened last night?
Yeah. I don't think anybody's much more angry than I am. Because I was in the courtroom and saw those people today, and I don't like it. I've been busted and I've had my head busted, and when I see other people, you get like a flashback of pain. I don't like it. And Ronnie was there with me, Jerry Hoos was down there. We saw these people come out. We saw the blood, the cake blood on them. Like, I am angry, very angry, but I didn't think this was the way.
You thought this was foolish tonight?
Yeah, I would have liked to come down here with pans and buckets tonight and collected money for bail, money for medical supplies, maybe money. Like when those kids came out, we had to go around and give them money for tokens to get home. They didn't have that. One hadn't eaten in 24 hours. Give them money. This is what I'd like to see right now, that people are hurting from last night, and let's take care of the hurting ones before we hurt more. And I'm all for demonstrations. You've known me a long time. I've been in every f***ing one. This is the first one I have not participated in. I couldn't. And I think maybe it's because I sat there and saw the cake blood and saw those people today. And most of these people that were in this demonstration tonight did not, nor did they care about the bail, nor were they down there to wonder what happened to those people. Sorry.
What is that fellow's name?
Hank.
You differed with what Bob had to say.
Yeah, I'm finding it a little hard to talk because my throat is killing me. It's completely sore. But I'm with Bob all the way, really. But I do think that we didn't come down here. The group that I was with, who was supposed to be going there from Chile, we didn't come down here looking for trouble. We came down here in a joyous spirit, I think, to show our solidarity and to be with the people. A lot of people lost sight of this, and around six other people, plus myself, tried to bring the march back, break the march up into small groups of people on Christopher Street, milling around, talking, showing solidarity, getting a feeling of brotherhood. What happened was there was a lot of other people who I don't know they are. They weren't all gay, definitely not. I know a lot of them were straight. and they started little hassles, like one person would call another person a pig, and a lot of people would crowd around in this type of atmosphere that was around. People would crowd around this thing. We had a lot of trouble. There were people taking on a position of marshalling on their own just to keep, you know, the trouble down and drain the energy so there wouldn't be trouble, bring it out in other ways. Well, there were people banging on cars, tipping, you know, trying to tip cars over. We tried to stop this. The main trouble happened was we were still mainly on the sidewalks, rapping, talking and whatnot. There were some people in the street, and all of a sudden, TPF came in from Sheridan Squares, you know, came in from that direction, and came in from this direction, from 6th Avenue, and converged in the middle, on, you know, and were not, this was the first case I ever saw where they really didn't wait for people to move, because I was shoved, I didn't even, you know, the very first thing, I didn't know there was a cop behind me, shoved me, yeah, move. They weren't waiting. Then, this one guy, he may have harassed the pigs. I'm not sure what happened, but he was told to move, and my mind was someplace else. And the next thing I knew, he was being arrested and dragged away. I got very mad, and I lost sight of, you know, all serenity and keeping peace. I said, are we going to let the pigs, you know, shit on our brothers like this? Stop them. Which was wrong. And the guy got away out of the pig's grasp, ran, and then they caught them and stomped him and then pulled him away. And then all the other arrests were made. I do think it's wrong that we didn't get down here and really get anything good accomplished, such as bringing the buckets. I don't know what happened with that. We were supposed to be doing that. That's how we left the meeting, saying we were going to do this also. Another thing, when we were at the meeting planning this, if some people were against it, thinking that, you know, that this would only lead to trouble, and, you know, stuff like that, that the crowd couldn't be controlled, nobody said a word. And we all went there with a joyous feeling, solidarity and brotherhood, to, you know, just emanate this feeling throughout Christopher Street and throughout the whole general area. And, like, yeah, I'd say it's because of a few heckling, you know, troublemaking few that shit came down tonight. And, well, not because of them, but because of the police brutality, and then these hecklers, you know, these few who didn't care, who were just looking for the trouble, the very few of them who retaliated and made the trouble worse. Because it was police harassment to begin with, definitely. Without cause, as usual.
A lot happened last weekend to raise serious doubts in the minds of many homosexuals as to how long it will take to achieve freedom, or if any homosexual alive today will be a freely accepted member of society in his lifetime. On the one hand is the continuing harassment of the street gays and the drags, harassment by police and politicians in the form of hundreds of arrests in the last few weeks, and harassment by straights, as in the beating by a gang of straights of three homosexuals in the Village. There was the refusal by NYU of the use of its hall for a gay dance, leaving homosexuals the choice of illegal after-hours bars run by underworld characters in collusion with payoff-accepting police, and the alternative to that, the risk of arrest for solicitation while cruising in the streets, alternatives which most homosexuals are confronted with every day. On the other hand, the expressions of disgust and anger, born of frustration against the police and society in general, have led to brutality, as those few homosexuals who are brave enough to stand up for their rights are outnumbered by the police and by society in general, and ill-prepared for violence. The answers to these problems will not come easily, and Pete Wilson and I will be trying in the weeks to come to explore some of the possibilities. One announcement before we close. There will be a dance sponsored by an organization called Gay Youth on September 12th, that's next Saturday, at 9 p.m. at Alternate University at 530 6th Avenue. There'll be a light show, special sound system, a photo exhibit, movies, refreshments, all for a donation at the door of $1.50. And those who don't have the money will be permitted in anyway. The dance, even though it's called a gay youth dance, that's only the name of the organization, the dance will be open to anyone of any age or any sex. That's Saturday, September 12th at 9 p.m. at Alternate University, the corner of 14th Street and 6th Avenue. The address is 530 6th Avenue. This is Homosexual News, Reviews, and Commentary. My name is Charles Pitts.
Homosexual News with Charles Pitts was pre-recorded. This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City at 99.5 FM.
Eyewitness. An interview with Dr. Herbert Needleman of the Committee of Responsibility, an organization of physicians working to bring severely injured civilians from Vietnam to the United States for therapy and restorative surgery. The interview was broadcast live over WBAI, July 8th of 1970. The interviewer is Bill Schechner, and the first voice heard is Dr. Needleman.
First statistics about civilian war casualties were released by the government of Vietnam. It was then the Key government in late 1966, and they were that there would be 50,000 civilians admitted to the hospitals with war injuries in the year 1966. Now, our studies and Kennedy's studies have indicated that for every person who gets into the hospital, there are two or three who never make it. So we're really talking about perhaps 150 to 200,000 civilians killed or wounded every year.
When you say hospital, what do you mean? Well, I know what I think of, but right. It's probably far different from what you're talking
about. It's incredible. Before I went to Vietnam, I talked to every physician I could. I read everything. I looked at all the pictures, and nothing prepared me to walk into an average provincial hospital. The province is like a state, and the provincial hospital is located in the capital of each province, so that there would be one provincial hospital in Albany if this were applied to the United States, and one in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They were built by the French, which makes them 30 years old. They're low.
Right,
minimally. Many of the buildings go back further than that. They're crumbling. They have no screens on the windows. The toilets are all blocked up with excrement. They're unusable. There's garbage in the courtyards, garbage in the hospital corridors. The initial thing that happens when you walk into to a Vietnamese hospital is the odor of excrement and pus and garbage. It hits you just like a physical blow. It's incredible. Weeks after I came back, I couldn't get that stench out of my nostrils. And then you see people, two and sometimes three to a bed, and sometimes on the patients on the floor or on litters. You see flies walking all over open wounds because, as I said, there are no screens. The Vietnamese family structure is a tight one so that the family stays there and patiently fans the flies off the children or the adults. Walk into the operating rooms, air conditioning generally doesn't work so that the place is hot, and again flies, and terrible amounts of filth. Electric power is intermittent so that there may be one light bulb per corridor, one light bulb per ward. That doesn't matter because there are no attendants at night. In the afternoon, everybody goes home and the patients are left to their families if there are any families there for care. Water supply, in many places, there's not running water in these hospitals. That's the situation for the people who are lucky enough to get to the hospital.
So then it would be fair to say that a hospital really is a hospital only in the sense of it's a collection of people who need treatment, who are put together, and there are a certain amount of limited facilities, but in terms of antiseptic care or medical equipment, that kind of stuff, it really is not a hospital as we know it, is it?
Right. I would say, and I think I'm being fair to this, that although there are a lot of well-trained people working there and working very hard, that A hospital in Vietnam must be fairly similar to a hospital in our Civil War. Well, there's more anesthesia, more modern drugs, but in general the surgery is that nature. It's acute, radical surgery to amputate limbs, save lives, etc. There's very little elective surgery done. People who need elective surgery may have to wait months and sometimes a year or so to get into the OR. And the filth and squalor is incredible.
There must be a considerable amount of all kinds of communicable infections in these hospitals, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people who probably burn cases are extremely susceptible to infection.
Right.
I would imagine that cases who come in, and if facilities were more adequate, would be discharged successfully after a stay, probably die in the hospital.
Not in the hospital, because the Vietnamese family structure is tight, and they don't want, when they see that a member of their family is failing, they take them home so that they can die at home, because they believe the spirit is emitted at the time of death, and they want that spirit to reside in the home. So that the death rate in many hospitals is very low, because when the person starts sinking, the family will take him out, and that's kind of encouraged by the hospital staff, too. Yeah, the surgery and the medical care is very primitive. I've seen in some of the better hospitals, I saw a fresh burn case right next to a case of open typhoid fever. So, you know, the infection rates are incredibly high.
Mm-hmm. How is the professional staff? Is there a professional staff outside of a few physicians?
Well, there are 1,000 Vietnamese physicians in Vietnam, but 700 are in the military. So it leaves about 300 for the rest of the population. Of that 300, about half have lucrative private practices in the city. So for the rural population of Vietnam, 14 million people, there are about 150 Vietnamese physicians. It's about 100,000 potential patients per doctor. That's supplemented to some degree by American physicians, military and civilian, on loan to the Vietnamese government. The same kind of ratios apply to nurses, nursing shortages. There are huge shortages of nurses and midwives, technicians, etc. And all the other backup things like garbage collectors, sanitary engineers, sterilizing machine runners, you know. The whole system is just crumbling.
What does it look like in one of these hospitals? I was going to ask you to describe what happens to a patient after he comes in, but maybe it would be more graphic to just describe a ward.
Sure. The hospitals are generally of the single one-story tropical architecture with clay roofs. And I've seen patients come into the courtyard after a strike or after there's been some action out in the hillside, come in by their own means. I've seen actually a family come in on bed with a member of the family on each corner of a bed, and then they're brought to the emergency unit where the immediate triage is done. If the person can be helped, the immediate first aid is given. Then they're shuffled off to a ward, which looks there are two rows of beds down and a narrow corridor separating them, and in each bed there are usually two people. Often two people, sometimes three children to a bed. The most characteristic thing, and just to be redundant, is the odor. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Everything just feels dirty. There's a kind of slippery feeling about everything. Attendants are scarce. The Vietnamese I want to be careful I say this. They're a stoic people. They don't weep and scream a lot, but I don't mean to say that they don't feel pain. A lot of people are given to the kind of myth, well, that Asians are used to suffering, etc., and they don't mind it. They mind it just as badly as anybody else. They just don't make a lot of noise about it. They suffer very quietly, and you can hear, even on a pediatric ward, very little crying, very little loud crying. You hear whimpering and moaning from even the most severely wounded people, and I've seen terribly burned children in Vietnam. It's one of the points at issue. You know, when we first formed our committee, we began to speak very clearly. I think we were one of the few American groups that were speaking clearly about civilian casualties. And suddenly a number of witnesses popped up, and they continue to pop up, who have never seen napalm children. They say they've never seen a napalmed civilian. This is an important point out to me because I think it's easy to find volunteers who have not seen certain kinds of wounds. One's reminded of a story told by Lincoln. He was supposed to have been prosecuting a man for murder, and because he had supplied three witnesses who saw the man pull the trigger, so the defense found five witnesses who did not see the man pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after we began to talk about what we had seen, a number of eminent people, including Dr. Rusk of this city, reported that they had not seen napalm in their visits, napalm victims in their visits to Vietnam. Well, I have in every surgical facility I visited in I Corps, and that was six hospitals.
That's the, this is WBAI in New York City. That's the first corps, is the northernmost.
Right, from area. The demilitarized zone down to Da Nang, just about.
Right.
It's where the fighting has been the hottest. That's where most of the napalm has been dropped. And if you go to those hospitals and if you ask questions, if you ask to be shown napalm casualties, you'll see them. They're there.
Do they, are the predominant, are most of the people in the hospitals victims of burn via napalm?
No, not a lot. You don't see a lot of them, and that's because most of them die. If there's a strike and the napalm is dropped, the people who were in the center of the strike don't live very long.
Mm-hmm.
If there were people burned on the outskirts of Manhattan and it took over 2 hours to get to a hospital, many of them would die from shock in the process. And most Vietnamese take 8 to 24 hours to get to a hospital because they come in by their own means. So that the only napalm victims one sees in the hospital tend to be the milder ones are people who, by some kind of miracle of resiliency, survived long enough to get in.
I remember in the material I read in the Washington Post, reports of what, at least to my mind as a layman, seemed to be extremely primitive and reverse treatment of burns.
Yeah, that was the burn unit at Da Nang.
What? Talk
about it. It's an incredible story, and I've witnessed the same kind of thing. George Roth, that was George Roth's third visit to Vietnam, so he speaks from some experience, described in that report walking into the burn unit and watching a very competent and a very compassionate Vietnamese nurse change dressings for this whole unit of burned children. She had one bathtub filled with water, and she would place the child standing in that bathtub, and the mother who was there would then begin to lave the child with water in a small pan, and as the water hit the child, he would start crying because it's painful. And then as the
crying, as I remember, is an understatement.
Yeah,
screaming, right.
And then as the dressings loosened, the nurse would peel them off, and the child was left like a bright red lobster with this open skin. And then the child stepped out, and to George's amazement, another child stepped into the same bathwater, and the process began again. And for the entire unit in the Da Nang burn ward, there was one single tub of water used. George felt that the nurse in charge of this was an incredibly competent woman. That's all she had to deal with. And she was stoic and at the same time compassionate. But this is not unique. Da Nang is one of the bigger and better hospitals. It's one in which more American money has been put in than many others.
Just to step sideways for a minute, Da Nang is the major American base in the northern portion of South Vietnam.
Right.
Do civilian casualties get into American military hospitals?
On a limited basis.
How limited?
Quite limited.
Limited enough to say that it's virtually has no impact?
Well, very little has any impact on when you're dealing with a problem of these dimensions. I guess about a year and a half ago, Ted Kennedy began to put some pressure on the Department of Defense, since there are many empty beds in American military hospitals, that they be utilized for
WBAI New York
for civilian care. There was some opening of access to these beds, but the House Armed Services Committee interfered with this to a certain degree, and while technically there is admissibility into these hospitals, it's very difficult. John Balaban, who was another one of our workers, described seeing a very badly injured kid show up at the door of a military hospital and be turned away because the child hadn't come first through the usual admission route, which is the village dispensary. This child short-circuited that route and was not admitted and died because of this technicality. Now, I can't say that happens all the time, but I do know that there are many civilians who need care who are not getting into our military hospitals and are suffering because of it.
I think I'm correct in saying that the military hospitals, and I don't know if it's a policy or whether it's I don't know if it's written policy or whether it's just pragmatic policy, but they operate at high levels of capacity in respect to the ratio of beds in use to beds available not anywhere near 1-to-1.
Right.
They keep it that way purposely because they say they need reserve capacity, but the effect of it is to have a lot of empty beds in the military hospitals most of the time.
That's exactly right. That's calculated policy. Mm-hmm. It's in their guidelines or manuals of procedure that...
Which seems incredible to me that there isn't sufficient flexibility to use these beds much closer to capacity, and if something happens where they need the beds, to move people around and create beds.
Yeah, medical care for GIs in Vietnam and in this country, the acute medical care is excellent. You know, there have been grave questions raised about rehabilitative care once the person gets out of the acute installation. And in the evac and field hospitals in Vietnam, it's excellent. And I agree with you. I don't think it would be compromised if they increased the utilization of the facilities, and certainly this would help the Vietnamese. But it just has to be said that our concern for the Vietnamese civilian is very slight. I mean, you don't have to be a super sleuth to put the pieces together. It's a low order of priority, and it only exists as a priority because at one point our government thought there was political mileage in it. Our medical programs in Vietnam were widely advertised as being our most important weapon in winning the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people. Weapon was the word used, and this was advertised at the American Medical Association convention. Now, that's an obscenity. Medical care is not a weapon. It's a service that you deliver to make a living or because you have a skill that people need. You don't use it in order to make people like you or subscribe to your political beliefs. But because our government has perverted it to these ends, the quality of it must suffer. Because when it, you know, the initial goal is a political one, not a therapeutic one.
I just want to pause a minute and say who we are. My name is Bill Schechner, and I'm here every morning in place of Larry Josephson, who's on vacation. And this morning I'm talking to Herb Needleman, who's a psychiatrist from Philadelphia. That's better than a Philadelphia lawyer, right? Yeah. Philadelphia doctor doesn't quite carry the stigma.
Yeah.
And he's a member of the Committee for Responsibility, which is a unit of physicians who have concerned themselves with the quality of medical care for civilians in Vietnam and have worked to bring severely injured victims of the war to this country for rehabilitation. And we're talking about the committee, and particularly right now about the medical problems of the Vietnamese civilians, a problem which is almost never talked about in the papers. I think that's one of the major running journalistic scandals of the war, that what you've described, the hospital system that you've described inherited from the French, sounds 16 hospitals for the entire population.
44
hospitals.
provincial hospitals.
For 16 million people.
For 16 million people. And then there's some private hospitals,
right,
too. But that's the provincial governmental hospital system.
And that inherited from the French. And so a system based upon, for one thing, based upon a paternalistic notion, I'm sure that people will take care of themselves, or large property holders will take care of those who get sick on their properties, and so on and so forth. And much more important than that, not in any respect adequate to deal with a war situation. What happens? What is the total capacity of those hospitals? Do you have any estimate?
Oh, I did. That figure escapes me at this moment. No, I wouldn't want to be inaccurate about it. I think there might be 3,000 beds or more, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be inaccurate about that. I do know that there are 44 provincial hospitals that vary greatly in size. Let me, I agree with you that one of the major scandals is that there has been decreasing attention paid to the human cost of the war in this country, and the medical situation has received almost no attention in the past year or two. The initial spotlight was thrown on this issue by Neil Sheehan, who was the Times correspondent in Vietnam. The Times at that point was doing, I think, some very vigilant coverage of Vietnam. Their coverage has decreased in intensity, I think, in the past year or so, and I think this may be true for many other newspapers.
One of their, just to interject, one of their guys there now, James Sturba, is one of their young Turk correspondents.
Good reporter.
Yeah, you've met him?
No, I've read
his. Yeah, his stuff is much better than anything that's come out of Saigon in the Times in a couple of months, but I don't want to talk about that.
Right. But I think it's very important, and I think this is an important task for the Committee of Responsibility, in addition to direct care, is to call attention to the war in terms of its human costs, the human terms of it. Not the body counts, not the geopolitical hogwash that we hear, but that this war is something that is being done to people, a very beautiful people, by our people. And we're paying dues for that, too. We're paying increasingly severe dues for what we are perpetrating there. I lecture to Philadelphia police rookies as part of my work in community psychiatry. And about 30 to 40% of those men are Vietnam veterans. One of my seminars with them is on violence. And some extraordinarily interesting and to some degree frightening things have emerged. Let me tell you about that. In a recent series of 8 hours, I began by talking about problems in the city, and one of the new recruits, the first question asked me was, do I think society's falling apart? I said, that's a very interesting question. I didn't expect to hear it in this group of 70 men. What do you think? He says, yes, I do. I think that the fabric is falling apart. There are a lot of young recruits who felt that way. So I went into a discussion of the critical issues that this country must face, and contrasted that with the way we are assessing our priorities, and talked about $100 billion being spent in Vietnam to kill people. When I came back the next session, a young man stood up, which is very unusual, and said, Doctor, you said some things that disturbed some of us in this room when you said we spent $100 billion to kill people. What did you mean by that? Well, I asked how many people had been to Vietnam, and about 30%, and I established that I'd been there too. We'd been to some similar places, so we had a common language, and I laid out my case for this. There was a great deal of responsiveness to this. I then said that the next session was going to deal with violence, and I wanted them to ask themselves why the human organism was the only animal that tortured, that made piles of its enemies' skulls, or cut off ears for trophies. And when I saw them in the next session, I did give a fairly academic lecture on some experimental studies on violent behavior. And at the break, this guy came up to me, and he said, he asked me if I thought it was sick behavior to cut off ears. And I said, why'd you ask for it? And he said, well, he had In fact, all of his buddies had up at Dong Ha. It was common behavior. He said, I did it. She was dead, Doc. With a kind of sick smile on his face, I said, you're like a good psychiatrist. I said, how do you feel about it? He says, I don't feel anything. I wanted to bring it home, put it on my rear view mirror, and let my wife see it. I said, I was really at a loss for words. I did not know how to
respond.
Was
that a joke, or was that...
No, he was deadly serious about it. He was embarrassed, but he was deadly serious. He wanted to put the ear on his rear view mirror. At the next session, I opened this up with the guys. I said, we have a good sense of rapport. We talk freely. Some of the men had remarked this. And I said, in that sense, I'm going to break the confidence and talk about a private conversation I had with one of you, because I think it's extraordinarily important. Every combat soldier in that room had seen or been involved in atrocities. They were of very mixed feelings about them. Some guys were ashamed. Some guys felt that this is it. This is war, and they had seen their buddies submitted to mutilations, the bodies of dead buddies. Five guys, I asked how many had seen, directly seen and not heard reports of it. Five guys had. And I kept saying that I am concerned about this because these men in the room are going to have people who are completely helpless, under their complete control, with their hands cuffed behind them, people that they will be angry about, people that they will have been afraid of before they apprehended them, and many of them had this kind of experience of cutting off ears or other things. And what were the implications of this for future police work? I think that's something we all ought to think about, and I think it's something we all ought to realize, that a whole host of guys, over 2 million guys, are coming back, many of whom will have been taught that counter-terror in the service of political goals is legitimate. And many of them are going to be policemen, for one. Some of these guys were concerned about it. Others felt that it was perfectly normal behavior. That's the kind of dues that we're paying because of this war.
It's hard to follow that with another question. Let's talk a little bit about the civilian... the civilians who don't make it to the hospitals. And then after that, I want to talk about your encounters with the Vietnamese and American officials there and the committee's work in trying to get some of these people brought out.
Sure.
And after that, we'll do some phone calls. So those who want to talk to Dr. Needleman will get a chance later on. What about the civilians who don't make it to the hospitals? And they must be enormous numbers of them.
Yeah, well, nobody has a real good handle on it. We can only guess at it. We did a study in I Corps in the first region again. A young Harvard medical student went under our sponsorship about a year ago and simply asked with somebody, an American who spoke Vietnamese, asked of each patient, where do you live? Where were you living when the bomb or the bullet struck? How many in your family survived? We discovered this, that the people in the hospital in the main came from an area of a very small radius outside the hospital. Perhaps the hospital in general was draining only one-third of the province, or less. The very narrow strip around the hospital was serving most of the patients were served from that area. And that a significant number of patients reported that other members of their family were killed or haven't seen them since. So that our estimate is that at least for each patient in the hospital, there are at least two, probably many more who don't. Now, a lot of those just die. There are a lot of dead Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those are listed in our body counts as Viet Cong. If it is dead and not white, it's a Viet Cong, is a common kind of shibboleth. A lot of them, I think, are treated in the NLF village clinics. We've heard about those. I've never seen one. I've never been that far out in the field, and I wouldn't go at this point if I could. Goodness knows how many others are dead. We do know that, just to give you another index, In 1967, the government of Vietnam reported that there were 40,000 amputees in the country. In World War II, our military suffered only 20,000 amputees. So the Vietnamese population has officially sustained twice the number of amputees of our entire army. And you can't turn a corner in Vietnam without seeing an amputee. Mm-hmm. They don't take the time to produce artificial arms because they're a luxury item. They're not able to cope with the need for artificial legs.
Is this the kind of injury? I guess really the question I'm asking is, since these are war injuries, they're going to be either burn cases, which are extremely delicate to deal with.
Right.
Burn is one of the, medically speaking, is one of the most difficult things to treat, isn't it?
It's tough, sure. The pathophysiology is very difficult, right.
Burn units in hospitals in New York. In fact, I think there are only one or two. I know there's one in Harlem Hospital, and I think there's another one at Downstate Medical Center.
It's a highly specialized problem to do it the proper way.
If you don't do it the proper way, either you get a massive blood infection or a massive scarring, correct?
Right. Increased scarring because of infection or death from septicemia are probably the two most important complications.
So that would be one category of injury created here that requires highly sophisticated medical
right.
treatment. The other, what I wanted to ask was the kinds of injuries resulting from either shrapnel or direct hits with a live round,
right.
An injury other than an instantly mortal or mortal, say, within 20-minute injury. Are they terribly sophisticated problems to deal with medically?
Oh, sure. By Vietnamese standards, they are.
No, what I meant was that if there was personnel available, even lacking hospitals as we know them in this country, would it make an enormous difference? In other words, field medics in the Army do a certain amount of work, and they're not very highly trained. They're paramedical people,
right.
actually.
Right.
I guess what I'm getting at is your professional opinion as to how many injuries that are definitely treatable and are not treated and therefore lead to either amputation because that's the only place you can stop it,
that's,
or death.
That's a very difficult thing to come to grips with. For it, you know, if we look at our own experience with our own soldiers, the rapid evacuation has made more difficult problems that were once considered lethal now rescuable. And there are more guys with terribly grave rehabilitative problems in this country simply because they've been gotten off the battlefield quickly and resuscitated mm-hmm. and haven't died from shock or loss of blood. So the same kind of logic would apply to Vietnam, the Vietnamese, or should apply, although, you know, there clearly is a double standard. That is, if you could get the people quickly and if you could resuscitate them, then you would be dealing with more serious problems that were then treatable. The thing is, in Vietnam, that speaks for itself, I believe, is that you see very few chest wounds, multiple abdominal wounds, because they don't live to get to the hospital. You don't see very many brain cases, chest or abdominal wounds. You see mostly extremity injuries
mm-hmm.
or facial injuries. We've taken out of Vietnam three kids who have had, instead of mouths, little cookie cutter holes, which their lips were just completely shot away and then scarred down. Now, they could have lived, but what kind of life could they have lived?
Mm-hmm.
Just grotesque lives. One, the little fellow in Philadelphia, before we brought him out and the plastic surgeons went to work on him, had to lie on his back and tuck food into his mouth with a mirror because there was only one little corner in which he could feed himself. And we've had two girls, both on the West Coast, who have had similar kinds of wounds.
Is that a burn or a bullet?
No, that was a shrapnel injury. Just ripped his lips away.
Medically speaking, amputation is a something along the lines of a last-ditch attempt, isn't it? I mean,
should be.
We don't. Military medicine does not call for amputation until you've gone quite a ways. Either a lot of the limb has been destroyed or infection is very severe. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of cases with which if one proceeded with good orthopedic care, you could rescue the limb. And there are very few orthopedists available for the Vietnamese civilians, and so as an expedient, amputation is often done. We had a child, Nguyen Van Oa, whom we found in a hospital in Vietnam, who had had his arm shattered by a machine gun bullet. And the surgeons wanted to amputate, the parents refused, and he was lying there with just a bare bone in the cast. And we brought him out to Iowa, and with excellent surgical, orthopedic and plastic surgical care, saved the arm and restored it considerably. And he's back home with his family. Now, that's the kind of thing that can be done, but it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of skill, and it takes asepsis. There are a lot of Americans who have lost limbs in this war, too. I lectured at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital to the Naval Medical Reserve Unit. And when I finished my talk, I came out just as the movie for the patients was letting out. And I walked upstream through a couple hundred guys, many of whom were double amputees and some triple amputees, some guys who had had their faces shot away and were so ugly that they'll never leave the hospital, I'm afraid. So the cost of the war is, it affects Americans as well as Vietnamese. Terrible cost to us.
A lot of these shrapnel and similar injury kinds of effects are, I suppose, the result of the kind of fragmentation and pellet bombs and things that are used widely.
Yeah.
I mean, in addition to just direct combat, machine gun, high-speed machine guns which fire, I don't even know the statistics, but it's several thousand rounds a minute. It's an incredible amount of...
That one gun, I think, fires 300 rounds a second, some incredible number.
And fragmentation bombs which produce at the final, they explode three times, and the third explosion produces steel pellets which radiate for several hundred yards, and each bomb produces several hundred clusters of these pellets.
Right.
What's the official position of the United States government and the Vietnamese government towards civilian casualties, since they are directly war-related?
The official position is that both governments welcome any attempt to help the people of Vietnam. When we first formed the committee, we went to Washington to meet with the then Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern Affairs, William Bundy. And he said that they would prefer that we worked in Vietnam, that we set up a hospital in Vietnam. We pointed out that the U.S. government was investing at that time $40 million in that, and that we couldn't, our effort would be minimal if we attempted to work in Vietnam, but that there were an extraordinary number of hospitals in this country who still had empty beds, and that we could deal with this one specialized program. There's been continual pressure placed upon us to work exclusively in Vietnam. The government of Vietnam identified itself with this position also. Our government said that if we found any children and got passports for them, that promptly entrance visas into this country would be issued, and in fact that they would be given space that was available on outbound medevac flights. That was supposed to be fairly routine. It hasn't worked that way.
Let me just interrupt you, too. There are probably some people who are listening who got up since we went into what the Committee of Responsibility does. Just briefly recapitulate that and then go on.
Yeah, we're a group of physicians, laymen, clergymen who have been bringing Vietnamese war injured children to this country for plastic surgical, orthopedic, and rehabilitative care. And we're also interested in educating the American public about the real costs of the war in terms of human costs.
I just want to get at one thing that occurred to me while you were saying that. Working in this country enables you to deal on a countrywide basis, on a national basis in Vietnam with cases, but also is part of it because of the, in your view, the complete impossibility of establishing adequate facilities there?
There It's very difficult. I wouldn't say impossible. There is an organization that has developed the first-rate plastic surgical unit in Saigon, Children's Medical Relief International. They're doing a splendid job. But there's need for so many different kinds of services. There are literally hundreds of expert plastic surgeons in this country, thousands of pediatricians, thousands of orthopedists, that it seemed to us perfectly logical, since it's a 20-hour flight on a well-established air route, to just bring these kids out, put them in hospitals, give them total care, and move them back. There seems to me to be room to do both.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be hard to develop any large effective programs in Vietnam as long as this blasted war goes on. The corruption, the social dislocation make it, I think, next to impossible to build an effective facility with personnel in that country. It costs more in Vietnam than it does in the United States. Their inflation is much more severe. The shipment of goods from this country is compromised by the fact that most of it's stolen before it ever gets here. It becomes the property of the GVM when it leaves Oakland, and we exert no inventory control, and it just disappears. You can buy it on the streets of Saigon. Mm-hmm. It's hard to see in the hospitals.
This is WBAI in New York City. So the committee had received at least the assurances of the American officials that when passports were issued to children,
right,
they would be flown out.
Right. And
what happened then?
Well, we found the initial group of children in the summer of 67. And applied to the United States government, and weeks went by. What was supposed to be automatic ratification, in fact, took weeks. They had to investigate the authenticity of the war woundedness of the children, et cetera, et cetera. This was all certified, too, by the GVN. We went around the barn with them many, many times on this, many calls to Washington, trips to Washington. With each group of children we've evacuated, the same thing has happened. Now, we brought to our country's attention in April of this year a group of 15 war-injured children, the first large group that we tried to move in a long time. And what was supposed to be an automatic process took 6 weeks after the Vietnamese government had given us passports. 6 weeks these kids were sitting in Saigon hospitals while our government messed around on technicalities. And it wasn't until Nick von Hoffman and some other people covered this in the news that the kids were shaken loose. In the process, one child died.
What kind of technicalities?
Okay,
what do you think they were really up to?
Okay, the first thing that happened was that when our representative in Vietnam went to supposedly our liaison officer in United States Agency for International Development, the man who's supposed to help us, he said that, have we authenticated that these children are all, in fact, war injured? Well, we had the hospital charts on that. He said, that isn't adequate. Well, we don't have an intelligence network. He did not accept at that time, as a valid definition of war injury, a child who had picked up an unexpended piece of ammunition or explosive, or a parachute flare that had fallen short and burned somebody's house down and burned a kid. He said that in order for the child to be deemed war injured, there had to be correlations with troop movements in the area. In other words, we would have to have our own intelligence network and say, well, on such and such a day, this battalion was moving across here and they fired. This is nonsense. But he was a potent obstruction. I got a telephone call from Saigon, and then I called down the State Department and protested this, and we were told to then go to the U.S. Embassy because they were more aware of the committee's program and the political nuances. We saw a high-level officer in the embassy who said he was going to try to help us. This involved a whole new set of dossiers and covering letters being typed up and sent to this man. We have a very small staff in Saigon, by the way. A week or so went by, and he said it was out of his hands. We had to go back to this USAID officer. We continued to apply pressure from many areas. I tried to get to see Secretary Rogers. He was too busy writing a speech to see me. Then the press came in, and finally the kids were allowed to move.
Why? It's incredible. Why?
It is incredible. Well, it's incredible.
I mean, it must be more than bureaucratic.
Sure, it is.
Roadblocks.
I think there are a lot of people in the government who do not want to see injured Vietnamese children in this country because that's the truth of the war. That's one of the truths of the war, and that is that young people who have no reason to be shot and killed are being shot and killed wholesale. And I think some people are afraid of the impact of this truth.